Good afternoon. You're very welcome to today's edition of Saturday with Clare Byrne. On today's programme, the report published to banish notions of stroke politics will have the lowdown on the reopening of Stepaside Garda Station. Why is Leo Varadkar so annoyed with Mary Lou? Find out about the alleged Fine Gael strategy to take on Sinn Féin. Ryanair, a lesson in how not to manage a crisis. And Lucinda Creighton on making new friends in Europe. First, though, it's time for the news now with Sharon Tobin. Sharon, thank you very much. Joining us in studio today, we've Minister of State with Special Responsibility for Local Government and Electoral Reform, John Paul Phelan, Imelda Munster, Sinn Féin Spokesperson for Transport and Louth TD, and Daniel McConnell, Political Editor with the Irish Examiner. We're also joined by Brendan Ogle, Education and Policy Officer with Unite, and Paul Somerville, CEO of Somerville Advisory Markets. Lucinda Creighton, former Minister for European Affairs, will be here a little bit later on, but we want to start with the top news story you heard there about Stepaside Garda Station. And Daniel, you might start us off on this because we have the second interim report into why six Garda stations or which six Garda stations should be reopened. We had a statement from Jim O'Callaghan at Fianna Fáil today which said that the decision to open the Garda station was taken in June, but the report was dated the 6th of August. Now, in the last few minutes, we've been told that there's some confusion around that. You might explain.
The date, as it appears on the report, the front page of the report says 06/08/2017. But my information is that it's in American form, which means the dates and the months should be reversed. So that means it was presented or produced on the 8th of June, which would tie into the timescale because the report was given to the Department of Justice on the 9th of June and the matter was discussed by Cabinet four days later. So that would that timescale is far more credible.
But in fairness to Jim O'Callaghan, you couldn't blame him for making that mistake, right? Because
we don't use American dates
in this country.
We don't use, but maybe a phone call to check it out may have been
All right. Okay, but does it clear up the confusion around all of this and the allegations of stroke politics in your view?
No. I think what it shows is that Stepaside was one of a number of stations under consideration. Yes, there's a recommendation that Stepaside should be opened, but it's not. There's nothing in the report to my mind that says, first, definitely do this one. There's reference to Rush, there's reference to other Garda stations. And even the basis, I think it's on page 18 of the report, for opening or reopening Stepaside Garda Station, because there was consideration for Kill of the Grange and Dalkey as well. And they're all in a pretty close proximity to each other. And they said, if you're going to go for Stepaside, you shouldn't open the other two. But I mean, the primary reason given to reopening Stepaside is that it would enhance public confidence in policing, essentially. Now, there is reference to an increasing population in the area over the previous couple of years,
and it far exceeded the increases in other areas.
But I mean, as I said, you know, that this key line, which basically said, and I'll just get it here, would give rise to enhanced public confidence in the area it would serve. That's pretty watery. Like, to my mind, that's pretty watery in terms of the determinations of a Garda station. You know, having listened to all the exchanges of the Public Accounts Committee last week, having followed this throughout, it is clear that if this was not purely a policing decision, there was a political dimension to this. Stepaside was one of a number of Garda stations that went to Cabinet for consideration and got plucked out. That's it.
Okay, well, let's have a listen now before we speak to John Paul Phelan, to John Halligan. He was speaking to Juno McEnroe, wasn't he, in the Irish Examiner. Just take a listen to this.
At that meeting, we said that we had made it quite clear there was issues in the programme for government. My issue was the second review in the hospital, the mobile cat labs. Shane Ross said my issue is step aside. In fairness, Leo Varadkar said we'll get them over the line for you.
John Paul Phelan, he was promised step aside and he got it.
Well, actually, the decision on step aside was made by the outgoing Taoiseach ultimately. I mean, the final, it was made before the formation of Leo Varadkar's government, if you like. I disagree a bit with what Daniel said earlier on about the report. I mean, it's pretty clear, and I think, you know, the reason it's been published is that.
But in your answer there now, you haven't said that he wasn't promised step aside. I mean, he was.
Well, I don't think it was a case of having to promise, because actually the report says that, and it's all on population basis, it says that ultimately it could be Rush or could be a step aside. But I mean, even a small understanding of the way development has taken place in Dublin in the last few years and the way it's likely to happen in the next few years would indicate that step aside is the standout place. Like Whitehall, Harcourt Terrace, Dalkey, all places that are not going to see huge levels of development, but step aside is already a big town and is going to be a bigger town in the next
although
the
brass tacks are that we hear John Halligan saying, look, I wanted this, the cath lab, Shane wanted step aside, and they were told that, they would be brought over the line, and that looks as though...
But the decision had already been made prior to that. You know, that Enda Kenny's in his last... The last cabinet meeting was discussing this, but it was before Leo Varadkar was elected by the Dáil to be the Taoiseach.
Okay, so the report gave you the answer that you wanted and you needed to keep Shane Ross on side.
Well, actually, sometimes, and it mightn't always be the case, but sometimes reports do indicate answers that people of all sides want. I mean, I'm not aware of any public representative in South Dublin and of any party, local or national, that didn't want Step Aside reopened, principally for the reason that it's... the most likely population growth centre and of the stations that were closed.
Even though crime had significantly reduced in the early part of this year?
Well, if you look at the crime figures, actually, for the rest of the Dublin area, there wasn't much of a difference on crime.
No, I'm just quoting from the report here in the Step Aside area.
But on the crime figures, there isn't a huge variance. The variance is on population. And, I mean, I don't think it's unrealistic. You mentioned, Daniel, that the report talked about public confidence. I mean, part of the issue right across the country in terms of closing Garda stations was the issue of public visibility of guards and that matter of public confidence. I mean, most of Garda, you know, investigations and whatever into crime mightn't take place at, you know, the really small local Garda station level. But there is a sense amongst the general public that if you see a guard, whether it's in Garda cars or the fact that there's a Garda station that's open... That it provides confidence to the public in itself.
It's just that the people at Step Aside deserve that more than other people, that visibility.
The important part of all of this is, you know, the day this was announced, the June 13th, which was the day that Shane Ross and his local councillor had the big banner outside Step Aside Garda Station, we were told explicitly this was a decision taken for operational reasons. This was a Garda matter solely. That is clearly not the case based on what we've heard of the Public Accounts Committee and what we've seen in the report today.
Brendan Ogle, do you want to come in there?
So much fuss, so much old politics is how this strikes me, Claire. We were told with the new political dispensation after election 2016 that we would have new politics.
But you're not surprised now, Brendan.
Well, I'm not surprised, but I'm still going to draw attention to it. We were told we would have new politics. We would have a government that was supported by a range of independents, including Shane, who wrote about this type of thing very skillfully and very entertainingly on the back page of the Sun Independent for many, many years. It stinks of old politics. I'm just reading the transcript here from the interview with John Halligan that you played in the Irish Examiner. What struck me really about it this week, though, was how it manifested itself in the Public Accounts Committee. The Gardaí, as we all know, have been beset by crises, many of them of their own making. And we've just lost a commissioner who felt the need to resign. I think the Gardaí should be held account in the Public Accounts Committee. But on the station during the week, I heard an interview with Sean Fleming, the chairman of that committee, with your own Sean O'Rourke, the day before the Public Accounts Committee. And the deputy commissioner, or the acting commissioner, was being called into the Public Accounts Committee to explain things that it was very clear from the interview with Sean Fleming and Sean O'Rourke. Sean Fleming already knew that Sean Fleming already put into the public domain in that interview, i.e. why it was that the acting commissioner was unable to carry out a previous promise to produce this report within a couple of days of a previous sitting.
So are you criticising Sean Fleming and the Public Accounts Committee?
I think the Gardaí need, given the current state of crisis in that organisation, need to be held to account, but they don't need to be treated like a political football. And that's what I heard.
Well, you're in agreement with Fine Gael's Colin Brophy then, who said it was one of the most debased committees in the Dáil.
Well, I didn't hear Colin Brophy, and if I'm in agreement with Colin Brophy on something, it's the first time.
But it certainly
first time
would be.
But I do think if politics isn't to continue to debase itself, these issues need serious analysis, and we shouldn't be dragging in acting commissioners
What's wrong with the Public Accounts Committee bringing in people and holding them to account?
Absolutely nothing. But it should be holding them to account to bring into the public domain information that isn't already in the public domain. But 24 hours before the meeting, all of the information related to this was told to the listeners
but
of the
show. But
that's
not true, actually, Brendan, because in fairness, like, having watched the interaction with Acting Commissioner O'Coolan, there was a significant amount, particularly about the chronology of what happened and the decision-making, came out under questioning at the PAC. I disagree with Colin Brophy, and I'm someone who's covered the Public Accounts Committee for over 10 years. I mean, in my view, it has done the state some credible service.
Agreed.
And it was behind some of the most, I think, the most disgusting abuses of this state, and it was the uncovering of those abuses in this state. You know, people have criticised it for going over the top in relation to the Angela Kearns case and in relation to rehab and CRC and all the rest of it. By and large, having sat through most of, if not all of those sittings, it did a good job on behalf of the taxpayer.
I agree with all that. But
in terms of dragging in a Garda commissioner, like, it needs to happen, given how dysfunctional the Garda force is and has been in recent times.
And I made that point. Yeah. But I think, and I fully agree with everything you've said about the Public Accounts Committee, but in this specific instance, the acting commissioner was brought in to put on account his explanation for issues, which Sean Fleming already knew the day before and put into the public domain on RTE Radio.
So what your problem is, your problem is with Sean Fleming going on the radio?
My problem is with the fact that the Gardaí are in a state of crisis. There needs to be fundamental reform. We've got an acting commissioner. And then in relation to one Garda station, in relation to one constituency and one minister, rather than that work of reform taking place, we have them made a political football. It's a relatively minor issue, and it's old politics.
Imelda Monster, I want to bring you in here because Sinn Féin promised to reverse the closure of Garda station. So are you happy to see the ball rolling?
Well, I think there were overall 136 Garda stations closed, and we had argued that they shouldn't be closed, that they're there to serve as rural communities. But I think the reopening of Stepaside is all the hallmarks of a political stroke. I think when the acting Garda commissioner addressed the Public Accounts Committee, his response when questioned about it had said, we did what we were asked to do. Now, Minister Flanagan needs to publish the interim report because for the simple reason...
Well, he hasn't published it today.
He hasn't made it available to the Public Accounts Committee members when they were discussing this. And I think he's done it under the fact that it's come into the you know, it's been highlighted and in the media, and they're under pressure to publish it now. If there were any problems or questions around it, they would have published it prior to this, if their arguments stood up. Because what we need to find out for sure is what the selection criteria was for what the government said was required for the reopening of a Garda station.
So we
need to know what the criteria is that the government maintain is required for the reopening of a Garda station.
Let's get real here. If you're trying to form a government and you're trying to get independence on board, you make them promises. You make them promises, and then they come on board. You win their support. That's how it works.
But another promise,
you're shaking your head. That's how it works.
Unfortunately, you're right. It's old politics.
Another promise that the government made was for a new era of new politics, and clearly this is back to the same old political strokes, and that's not right.
Is it frustrating for you, John Paul, that you know you have these independent guys coming in? You're relying on them for support. They go, their wish list goes to the top of the list. You're putting in the hard yards and you fall to the bottom.
Not at all, because in the case of South Dublin, my colleagues Josefa Madigan and Senator Neil Richmond have been shouting about, Neil Richmond lives 200 yards from Stepaside Garda station, the closest public rep of any party.
But he doesn't get to stand outside with the banner saying,
well,
I got this reopened for you.
Maybe he did. I suspect that he'll get as much credit for it as anybody will locally. But I mean, the idea that, and just put forward by Imelda, Sinn Féin want all the Garda stations reopened, but just we're going to make a kind of a football out of this one, even though it stands out pretty clear from the report which was published this morning, which I managed to have a look over before we came in studio, that if you're looking at the criteria, the key criteria is how many people will the station impact upon, and Stepaside stands head and shoulders.
That's not
above.
But it also said population growth was the primary reason for it.
Yeah.
But it also had, I had read this morning that crime stats were down
in the area in 2017.
So that's why we need to be very clear.
Crime stats are down.
Nothing to see here. Isn't that what we're hearing? Let's move on now. I want to talk about Mary Lou MacDonald and Leo Varadkar in the Dáil this week. Lots of conversation and comment about this, but maybe we'll just take a flavour of the exchange. Now listen carefully. Some of it is off mic, and it's worth keeping a close ear to this clip.
And what I said to him off mic was, listen, I'm not getting answers from you verbally. I
Like that, this is the constant pattern of debate that we have in this Parliament. It should be. It's great to see. The only time you're not scripted is when you're interrupting, actually, which is an interesting point.
Deputy, please.
Great.
Could we stop, please? Thank you very much. Deputy, please. You're on your feet. You might as well leave.
All right, and what you heard at the top there was Mary Lou McDonald speaking to Kieran Shanley later in the week and explaining that she went over to the Taoiseach and said that she would write to him in order to try and get answers. Imelda, what's going on in your view?
Well, it's clear from our point of view that the Taoiseach's new spin team have told them to target Sinn Féin, and particularly Sinn Féin female TDs. I myself was Minister Murphy, the housing minister, actually almost jumped down my throat earlier on this week when I raised when I was speaking on the homelessness and the housing crisis. There's obviously a clear policy here to target, but particularly female Sinn Féin female
TDs. What's
your
evidence for that?
Well, this week on three occasions this week, you had the incident with the Taoiseach with Mary Lou McDonald when she tried to raise the serious issue of tax breaks for the banks. Then myself on the Wednesday evening when I had addressed the motion on homelessness and the housing crisis, and I had merely pointed out to the minister that they were now 7 years in government, there were 90,000 people on the housing list.
Okay, but is Piers Doherty treated differently? Is Angus O'Snodhig treated differently?
It appears that this is deliberate targeting, and the Taoiseach
of
has
women,
been told
of women. That's a very serious allegation.
There were three incidents this week. Senator Rose Conway Walsh, when she raised rural issues in the Shannon, she was subject to massive arrogance and obnoxious response from another government minister. So three in 1 week, I think, is pretty serious. And if anything, it lends weight to the argument that it is deliberate policy of targeting Sinn Féin female TDs.
John Paul Phelan.
The previous week on questions, I was in the chamber for this week's one and the previous week's one. Micheál Martin received the brunt of the contact, we'll say, from the Taoiseach. Before the dawl broke, it was Paul Murphy in a very strong exchange. Sexism is a serious issue, and for Sinn Féin to trivialise it in such a manner and just really play the man instead of the ball. There isn't a sexist, but whatever you could say about Leo Varadkar, he's not in the least bit sexist. In the same Leaders' Questions debate the other day, Claire Daly had got up after Mary Lou McDonald to talk about how she respected the Taoiseach and the things he had done over the years to speak out on the Garda issue in particular. I think you can.
And then
you can
she said she was concerned that he had maybe changed
and that's
his
fair
tack.
Enough, but she didn't accuse him. Like, sexism is a very serious
allegation.
Would
he have said to a man that you're very cranky today?
He's often said it to me. I mean,
you can hear it
in his voice that he's actually joking when he's saying it. I just think it's pathetic.
Minister Murphy had accused me of bullying him on Wednesday night because I had.
But that's not sexism.
When I had, no,
do you
no,
know
he,
what sexism
no, no,
is, like?
No, I'm talking
that's
about.
It's senior
hurling. Three, no,
we're
no,
out here
it's,
now.
It's deflecting
not,
from the real serious
but that's not
issues.
Sexism.
And that's. No, no, I'm talking about. I am stating fact that three
about
the Taoiseach and
an
two government ministers deliberately targeted Sinn Féin female
Sinn
TDs
kind of
instead of addressing as a way of deflecting from the serious issues.
Can I just
bring a week away from budget 2018, yeah. And this is, you know, the government are seriously trying to deflect away from the issues regarding
well, it's very important to tease
thing.
This out.
But,
if this is what you're saying, that the sexism
ridiculous.
Is at play, it's important to tease it out. Can I just bring in what Gerry Adams said last night in OMA? He said, while all parties have the right to criticise other parties, it's obvious that the only motivation for the attacks on Sinn Féin by the Southern Establishment parties is their electoral fear of the growth of Sinn Féin.
Well, when you being in the chamber last week, it was quite striking, and it's one thing that's not clear, I suppose, sometimes when you're watching on TV, that Mary Lou McDonald is a very good communicator, gets her message across very well in the media and has done for years. But on that Leader's Questions type situation, she's always scripted, and the Taoiseach actually.
Who isn't scripted?
Why not? I'm not.
But why
the Taoiseach never lifts his head up from
the big
script.
Issue. That you bring it up as well.
Taoiseach,
I don't know why
actually,
it's a big issue.
Thing,
you're all scripted.
Hang on for a second. The Taoiseach on Leader's Questions is not.
There's
scripted.
A lot of paper in front
he's
of
not
you.
Scripted.
Today,
he has
John
a folder.
Paul.
He has a folder. Yeah, it's all about Stepaside, so I won't be doing it anymore. No, but the Taoiseach is not scripted on answering his questions. And this week was he just gave the obvious answer. She was moving her sheet of paper, which wouldn't be seen on the TV, and is soon as she went off script, there was this kind of radio silence on the other side. I mean, and that's a legitimate political argument to have, but to say that's sexism is an outrage.
We'll let people make their own mind up.
John Paul describes it as senior hurling. I might describe it as senior arrogance if what I witnessed last Friday is anything to go by. I was driving south from an event in the north, and I stopped at a well-known petrol station south of Dundalk, Carlingford, or Castle Bellingham, and I came across the Taoiseach's car in the car park, parked across three disabled spaces. I can't verify because I'm telling you on air. Parked across three disabled spaces while the Taoiseach was getting escorted by two security guards into the toilet. Now, the Taoiseach is a young man. He's come to lead this country at a very young age.
He's in charge.
Paul Somerville,
you're sitting here witnessing all of this. Go ahead.
I do actually think Sinn Féin have a point. I don't think it's anything to do with sexism. I think it's how Fine Gael manage the media, and they do it very effectively. Now, Piers Doherty was making huge progress on Wednesday, Thursday with the Finance Committee all about what the banks were doing this week. It would have been the biggest story that we would be talking about today. Now, what Fine Gael obviously do is they want to change the agenda. Mm-hmm. How did they do it? They changed it very quickly it's Trump tactics. Basically, they tried to deflect. So this is exactly what's happened on Friday. This story will go by next Friday. They don't care. Nobody else cares. Mm-hmm. But what their point is to try to deflect Piers Doherty was doing.
That would be good, except for what you said about Piers Doherty happened after the Mary Lou incident. So, I mean...
Was asking about AIB and taxation.
The Piers Doherty line was after, the chronology is wrong.
The media today, on any of the news, the main story is not about the banks, even though that was the main
but
story.
But you got your chronology wrong.
But it was the most important thing that happened in Ireland this week, is what Piers Doherty did.
Can I explore another theory here, which has emerged in commentary around all of this, that Fine Gael's strategy is to target Sinn Féin to the detriment of Fianna Fáil?
Yeah, I mean, there's clearly a stepping up of the level of aggression, probably not the right word, but in terms of combativeness from Fine Gael to Sinn Féin. There's those of us who would kind of question, why elevate Sinn Féin to that level? Because clearly all you're doing is putting them on a par with you. And that was evidenced by the fact that Mary Lou turned down an interview on Sean O'Rourke this week because she would only go on and debate with Leo Varadkar. Mm-hmm. So this is what we're in. These are the sort of games that are going on behind the scenes now. To say what happened this week was sexism is ridiculous. It was not.
I didn't say it was sexism. I said they deliberately targeted three. I didn't define it specifically as sexism. Let people make their own minds up on that. But there is a deliberate attempt to target Sinn Féin female TDs this week.
We'll take it that you didn't, even though you did. Your colleague Louise O'Reilly was on The Gathering yesterday, and she went to town on this issue, describing how Sinn Féin females were targeted on this issue. That is nonsense. Mary Lou MacDonald, I'm writing this morning in my column this morning. Mary Lou MacDonald, as John Paul has said, is one of, if not the most effective debater, orator on the floor of Leinster House. She does not distinguish in terms of gender. And you can ask Angela Kearns, Martin Callanan, Frances Fitzgerald, Joan Burton, and any of them, whether or not she goes any softer or any harder, depending on their gender. She doesn't. So therefore, she has to be treated exactly the same way. And as I actually used the phrase this morning, and I'm kind of referred back to Seamus Brennan's old line about senior hurling, that's what it is. No more, no less.
No, from my perspective, what I saw this week were three Sinn Féin female TDs raised three very, very serious issues. And as a mechanism to deflect from those issues, the government responded in an obnoxious and arrogant manner.
But Claire, you never get a straight answer.
From a government minister.
He had answered the question.
He answered the question on tax and AIB, but it wasn't the right answer that Sinn Féin wanted. It's spin, spoof and deflection. No wonder you've hired a new spin team, because
I'm going to leave this to serious issues.
Claire, I mean, this time yesterday, everyone was quoting Miriam Lord's article in the paper on Thursday morning, in which that this gender issue kind of was raised. And everyone on the side criticising Leo Varadkar, saying this was sexism. Miriam Lord in her column this morning saying it wasn't sexism. So, were they wrong? Was she wrong? No, it wasn't sexism. It was senior hurling, no more, no less. And that's kind of...
All right, let's leave it there. We'll take a quick break, back with more after this. Paul Somerville, Ryanair, talk to me. Are we at the bottom of this or not?
I don't think we're at the bottom of it yet. It's been an absolutely extraordinary couple of weeks for Ryanair. You know, if you had a lesson in how not to do crisis management, this would be it. And Michael O'Leary, you know, he's just had a shocking performance. There seems to be more to it. Don't forget, at the very start of this, they actually blamed the weather, which sounds absolutely phenomenal now. They cancelled the 200,000 flights. We all know about that at the start. He said he made that decision by himself at 4:30 on a Friday, then went home for the weekend. This was without telling any other passengers what flights were cancelled. It's just gone on, and it seems to be getting worse. And for the marketplace, it's quite an interesting thing for financial markets, because besides the scandal that's going on at the moment, there's also other announcements that he's been making which seem to be off the cuff. So, for an example, he on the 14th of September, he said he's preparing a takeover for Alitalia. On the 27th of September, he says he's not. Then in late August, he said he was going to bid for Air Berlin. Then he says he's not. So
from a market point of view, that's fluctuations are caused, very unsettling
for investors to see, well, what actually is the strategy going forward? And of course, you know, when we get then to his press conference last week, you know, he's showing a very erratic behaviour and the tantrums, again, not giving the passengers the information they need. And simply...
But we're used to all of that, right?
Well, the problem here is, for an example, if you are short of pilots, is it a good week to start slagging off pilots?
Well, you know, I wouldn't have thought so.
It's absolutely extraordinary. Yeah. We had pilots phoning in to London radio stations and trying to explain... what is happening to them with Ryanair. And it is extraordinary. They paid €300, for an example, to do an interview with Ryanair. Then if you actually get offered a job with Ryanair, you have to pay €29,500 just to do the training. Then you have to set up your own company because Ryanair will not employ you directly. So you, Ryanair make you set up your own company so you're self-employed. Now, all these things were not in the media as such up to a week and a half ago. And I think he's Michael O'Leary is totally underestimating the damage that he's doing to Ryanair at the moment. And one of the main problems with this company is, you know, this is a 19 billion euro company. And it's indistinguishable between Michael O'Leary and Ryanair. You don't have that with any other companies. So I would suggest...
Too much Michael, you're
saying.
Well,
I would suggest the management structure is absolutely lacking here, because this guy is making decisions off the cuff and he's acting in a very erratic manner, and I would suggest there's going to be more problems to come.
Brendan Ogle, I want to come to you on this because I was intrigued by something that Breed Smith, the People Before Profit TD, said. She said that... If this chaos inflicted on Ryanair passengers would have happened, if it were caused by a worker strike, that Fine Gael TDs would be jumping up and down.
Well, she's right, of course. I didn't hear that comment. I think what we're seeing, Claire, is the unravelling, not of Ryanair, time will tell about that, but of the Ryanair model as it relates to staff on the one hand and customers on the other hand. It's simply not true. That all of this is as a result of some HR blip.
Well, if it does unravel, Brendan, we'll all have to pay more for our flights.
Well, no, let me make the point there. It isn't true that it's a blip over annual leave. In at least 60 locations around Europe at the moment, Ryanair staff, not just pilots, but crew as well, are in not only communication with each other, but directly with management themselves, trying to initiate solutions to this crisis, offering to give up their annual leave in some cases for free, in order to ascertain or to bring about a better relationship with how they are treated. And some of the issues Paul has pointed out are absolutely disgraceful. That will happen because they've reached the bottom. They've run out of patience. They've taken enough. And that's the real story here. And that is manifesting itself now in a situation where if you're a Ryanair customer, who is going to go on today and book a Ryanair flight with any certainty that they can get on it? It's very interesting this week.
I'd
to
love
see
to know how they did, Brendan, with the seat sale that they had earlier on in the week.
That was very interesting. It was when they announced the 400,000 cancellations, they said no Dublin flights would be affected. Mm. 24 hours later, they announced 22 cancellations of flights per week. And you're saying to yourself, did they know that 24 hours previously? They must have known it. If they didn't, I mean, that's absolutely shocking as well. So it seems to be this drip of information that they seem to be unaware that actually getting in front of this crisis would be much better. And again, I believe that it's because Michael O'Leary is taking all the decisions and nobody else is helping.
And okay. In terms of the payment issue you raised, Claire, surely we aren't living in a society where you have to treat workers and customers the way they are currently being treated in order to run an effective business. We aren't living in that society. This is not necessary. It is not necessary to treat people like this.
OK, Imelda, can I bring you in here? Because you're a transport spokesperson. Mm-hmm. I mean, is there a role for politicians and for government here?
Well, I know we've... the Transport Committee just last week, we agreed to invite the Irish Aviation Commission in, authorities in, and also extend an invitation to Michael O'Leary. Now, it's very doubtful that he will take up the invitation, but there's serious issues around what's happened or transpired over the last week or more. They had announced firstly that there was 40 to 50 flights cancelled a day, but that the issue was to do with the roster over the holiday period. But I don't think anybody believed that. There's reports that over 700 pilots have left, and it appears that pilots are leaving in their droves, and there's no surprise there either. But I think the biggest issue would be the manner in which they've dealt with the crisis, and particularly in relation to their customers primarily, but also their staff. When, you know, they point blank withheld information to their customers and their passengers about the alternative rerouting that they could avail of. Now, why would you do that in a crisis situation? What sort of customer service is that? You would imagine anybody would say, you know, go bend over backwards to facilitate their customers, given that they had caused the crisis themselves, you know, to ensure that their family holiday or their annual trip wasn't destroyed or they weren't stressed out. Mm-hmm. But to do that, and the aviation authorities were furious with them. And I have to point out as well, it'll be something I would be looking at the Transport Committee, the British Civil Aviation Authorities took them to task, you know, and took action on it. But I think the Commission on Aviation Regulation was on RTE earlier in the week, and the spokesperson had said that they didn't have the power to force Ryanair to give the full information to their customers. Now, if the British Aviation Authority could do that, then why had our aviation regulations not sufficient powers. That's something that needs to be addressed, and addressed very quickly to ensure something of this magnitude doesn't happen again.
I just want to take another quick break, and we'll be welcoming Lucinda Creighton to the conversation after this. Former Minister for European Affairs and CEO of Vulcan Consulting, Lucinda Creighton, is here now. You're very welcome, Lucinda. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Claire.
There was an EU digital summit, as we know, towards the end of the week, and all the head people were there. But it always seems to come back, the headlines, to corporation tax, doesn't it? I mean, it really is something that we can't avoid, or is it?
Yeah, I suppose it's one of those issues. It's massively popular in other countries, and it's massively unpopular, obviously, here and in some of the EU countries. So it's a real kind of dividing line, and it always gets headlines. And it's the same proposals over and over again, you know. I mean, whether it was President Sarkozy in 2011, or whether it was Hollande when he was coming into office, and now Macron, the French are always pushing for this, but so far they haven't succeeded, not by any measure.
Mm-hmm. You need agreement across the EU on this, but when you have the big beasts pushing for it, you do start to get worried.
Yeah. I mean, you always have to be very tuned into these things. And you always have to be very vigilant. But, you know, I think from Ireland's point of view, rather than sort of obsessing about it, I think that we need to maybe flip our approach a little bit and actually start talking about, well, what is our ambition for Europe? What do we want to see? How do we want to see the future of the European Union without the UK? And what positive things do we have to say about it instead of always being on the back foot?
A Macron-style speech from Leo Varadkar, perhaps?
I think that would be fantastic. And no better man than Leo to deliver it, because he is genuinely passionate about Europe. And, you know, I think obviously our whole economic model is going to change to a large extent once the UK leaves the European Union, the single market and the customs union, whenever it happens. You know, it's obviously going to be somehow dragged out, but it is going to happen. And, you know, we need to think about, well, what is the vision for our country, and how does that vision fit into the broader vision for the EU? And we can't just wait around for others to tell us what their vision is, as Macron has done. And actually, there's an awful lot in his speech that's really good, really positive, really welcome, very ambitious. I wish we had more politicians who'd set out their vision in a 50 or 60 minute speech rather than the usual sound bites.
Mm-hmm. So we need to take a lead on it.
Absolutely.
Brendan Ogle, do you want to come in there?
Well, yes. Welcome, Lucinda, to the debate. In terms of a new economic model for Ireland. And the week when we had an announcement that there are 3,048 homeless children, and some of the biggest companies in the country pay less than 1% corporation tax, I think we absolutely do need a new economic model. And I'd be delighted to see one develop. The really disappointing thing, I'm a supporter of the European Union, of social Europe. What's happened over the last number of couple of decades, really, is we've moved from the European Union we joined into a neoliberal Europe, which is about social inequality and which the British, for their own reasons, which are very complex, have now left. The biggest disappointment for me, and I'd like to hear what Lucinda thinks about this, is since Brexit, I would have thought what the European institutions need is some critical self-analysis about what is it within the European Union that's gone so wrong that one of the biggest pillars of Europe has decided to leave.
Is that happening?
It can't all be about the British.
Is it happening?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's like any political entity, and obviously it's deeply political, whether it's the Commission or the European Parliament or the Council, which involves our own ministers and our own Taoiseach, there are differences of opinion. And some people, you know, blame the British for the decision they've taken. And by the way, one of the main reasons the UK have left is because it is a social union. They don't like the fact that they have to, you know, abide by European rules around labour laws and so on. They don't like the fact that they have to provide social welfare protection to other EU citizens. That's a very big part of why they've left.
The fact that
the European Union is trying to take collective positions on migration and immigration, the UK don't like that either. So, you know, there are a myriad of reasons as to why the UK is leaving, and a lot of them are to do with the fact that the European Union has become very much about a social Europe. And, you know,
I've just put out there that there are 3,048 homeless children in this country. And RTE News last night told us that some of the biggest companies in this country pay less than 1% of corporation tax. Yet you're telling me we're part of a social Europe. It's preposterous.
So the European Union is to blame for Irish corporation tax. I thought the whole point was that we set our own rates and implement our own policies.
We are the biggest cheerleader of the most aggressive advocate of neoliberal inequality on the planet.
Brendan, if you say that, then you would be in favour of tax harmonisation, which is a policy that is being driven by Macron, by Angela Merkel, Jean-Claude Juncker. They all want it to happen.
I am not a supporter, and I don't think this will come as a surprise to you or anyone else, Claire. I am not a supporter of Ireland building an economy on the basis that we are a tax haven for the biggest corporate cheats on the planet.
I've just said it, and probably on that alone, the French are right.
I think Brendan's absolutely entitled to have his view on how. Of course, you are, in terms of how we tax corporates and individuals and everybody else, and we all have views on those things. But you know, the idea, I mean, it's really digressing off the European agenda, because actually what we're talking about is how the European Union functions, what the vision is in terms of what it's going to do in the future. If we wanted to intervene in our corporate tax rates, you may well want the European Union to have that role. I personally don't.
I wish we'd do it ourselves, actually.
But the fact is that Emmanuel Macron and indeed Jean-Claude Juncker in the last 2 weeks have set out a particular vision for Europe. And I think we really now, as a nation, need to also set out our vision, the elements that we like of what they've said, the elements that we don't like, and also the elements that they may not have even mentioned that we can bring to the table that are constructive.
Paul Somerville?
If there was harmonisation of taxes in Europe for corporates, it wouldn't actually affect Ireland that much. And people seem to do not realise this. It's because the way these companies are structured means that we are declaring that these profits are not made in Ireland, or these companies. So don't worry about Macron. There was a more important speech on tax this week, which was Donald Trump. He made probably the most important speech of his presidency so far. And where he is talking about, now, the American corporations and how they're structured in Ireland. Well, he didn't mention Ireland, but, you know, we know he's talking about Ireland and trying to get them to repatriate their profits. It's a way more important subject for us because I believe...
He didn't address repatriation tax, or did he?
It was all broad, 35 to 20. Broad strokes, because what he announced was what they would like to do, and there's further discussion on it. So the detail was much lacking. But you can see him and his team are really gunning for this idea. They've been talking about it now since, you know, maybe for 2 years, and they're all on the same page, which is they're trying to get these American corporates to repatriate the money that is hidden offshore. And a lot of it is hidden, well, within Irish structures. It's actually not in Ireland. It's in American banks in America, but under Irish names. Mm-hmm. So that would affect our GDP hugely. So I wouldn't worry. I mean, I thought the speech from Macron was actually very good. It's very positive if you're pro-European. But just because he's saying tax harmonisation, don't believe that that's going to affect Ireland that much. If he brings in the way he's saying it, it won't affect Ireland that much.
Okay, but
watch out for
Trump.
Yeah.
Do you agree with that?
I absolutely agree that whatever Trump's intentions sort of turn out to be, because really it's still not really clear, but absolutely the idea of repatriating taxes would have an implication here, or indeed proper corporate tax reform in the US, where they're very, very high rates of corporate tax, which is why so many of their firms end up locating elsewhere. All of that will have a big impact. But, you know, I do think that when it comes to the European Union and Ireland's place in the European Union in terms of competing with other member states, which is, of course, what we all do with each other, and that's healthy, in my opinion. You know, if there were a drive to harmonising taxes at one rate across the European Union, of course we would lose a certain advantage. There's no question about it. And, you know, I don't think that too many of the countries with models like Ireland would embrace that or would want that, including the likes of the Netherlands, including the Baltic states, including Cyprus, Malta, etc. Largely geographically peripheral countries.
I think what Jean-Claude Juncker thinks of all this is going to be fascinating, because, you know, don't forget he was the Prime Minister of Luxembourg.
Absolutely.
When Luxembourg was set up as the biggest tax haven in the world at the moment. You know, he is the man behind that. Yeah. So, you know, it's quite interesting. So I wouldn't really, if I was an Irish corporate, I would not be getting worried about the tax harmonisation situation in Europe.
So, Jean-Paul, can we expect that our vision of Europe speech from Leo Varadkar anytime soon?
Well, I haven't had discussions about visions with the Taoiseach recently, but I do think it's, it's a fair
You weren't
point.
On LCD census last I know.
No. I was addressing councillors of Ireland in Clonmel in Hotel Manila, which was an important meeting in itself. But the discussion we never discuss Europe in Ireland, other than in the context of Brexit at the moment, or when there's a referendum coming up to pass a treaty, and generally the discussion that happens doesn't revolve around what's in the treaty at the time. There's all sorts of red herrings and other issues that are discussed that really aren't central. So I do think, now that, like, Britain's leaving of the European Union has been a constant nearly throughout my adult life. It's been criticism of the Union, cynicism towards the European Union, and eventually now Brexit vote being passed and very little preparatory work being done on the British government side for a plan B before the vote actually took place. And it was obvious, I think, to most observers that it was going to be a close vote. And we've had a year and a half, or whatever it is, since, of mostly slogans chanted by British ministers about, you know, Brexit means Brexit, or, you know, no deal is better than a bad deal. And a slow realisation that actually it's important for them as well to get a deal. So I think actually the vision type speech, when I got to know Leo Varadkar and Lucinda Creighton first, was involved in, partly at least, involved in the YEP movement, which is a youth movement for political, those who are involved in politics across the European Union. And he has strong views on the issue. And I think it probably is a timely point to have that.
Well, there are some serious issues that Macron raised, and he talked about a defence union, which would have implications, serious implications for our neutrality. So we need to set out where we stand on
that. But actually, if you look at Macron's speech, it's interesting. I mean, a lot of what he's calling for is already provided for. So we're all, you know, you already have EU battle groups that are supposed to be, in theory, ready to, within 10 days, be mobilised and deployed. If needed, if there's a threat which is agreed by the EU member states to merit a response, you know, that hasn't happened. And what Macron has proposed is really effectively implementing that. But, I mean, the provision is there. We've signed up to it. We're part of the battle group. So whether that infringes on neutrality, well, I would question whether we really have neutrality in this country in the first place. So
I think this EU intervention, our military force, he had also in his vision outlined the need for a defence budget. But I think that that is a direct threat to Ireland's neutrality. And I think the Irish government need to stand up on that and fight on that one. He's looking for, I think it was a joint doctrine of action as soon as possible. So, you know, somebody said earlier that the Irish government, both the Irish government and all of the Irish MEPs, do need to set out a productive and constructive vision, you know, and alternatives. Because what you have here now in, well, it's his vision for a sovereign Europe, if you like, it appears to me on the if you go through the different aspects, whether it's the military change that's been proposed or whatever, but that's actually undermining or compromising the sovereignty of other national parliaments, and that's not what the EU was supposed to be about. It was supposed to be a social Europe. It was supposed to be
an economy
block.
To stop people fighting.
Yeah, but it's supposed to be an economy block. But you now have a situation where it's heading into a type of a federal state, and people don't want that, and they're not taking into effect. They're not taking into account.
I can't hear everybody speaking together. Do you want to respond to that?
Well, the EU has already approved. The EU has already approved a common defence fund. So actually, this is not something new. That's something we are already signed up to. So it's not new. And the idea that the European Union is not about, you know, securing itself, making sure its citizens are secure from potential attack or threat.
Can I just stop you there, because the clock is against us, and I just want to have a quick word with you about Brexit and what's happening with Theresa May and Boris Johnson. Again today, he's out in the Sun newspaper outlining his four red lines for Brexit. I thought he was supposed to be keeping shtum and letting her get on with it, but that's not the case.
I think he's angling to get sacked. He's really putting it up to the Prime Minister. He's putting her in an impossible position. He's playing to the gallery. I mean, it's everything that we sort of have come to know Boris Johnson to do throughout
his
political...
It's the gift that keeps on giving, really,
yeah,
isn't it?
Absolutely. But I mean, I was in London yesterday. I met with a lot of businesses there. I met with a number of law firms who were really, really involved in the whole advisory side of the Brexit process, advising business. And they're very, very engaged with the government. And I mean, it is beyond worrying. I mean, nothing has happened. There is no meaningful preparation happening. They set up a Department of Brexit. They've now removed many of the senior officials or put them back into the Prime Minister's, into Number 10 Downing Street. So they're changing their mind on a whim, as is the Prime Minister, who's supposed to be leading this process. It is really catastrophic. And Boris knows that. And I suspect that he's trying to trigger his sacking and then a challenge for the leadership.
What do you think that the odds are, or the possibility are, of another referendum? Will it take an election and a change from the Tories in order for that to happen?
Well, you wouldn't require a referendum. Firstly, they can change their mind if they choose. I don't see a referendum happening. I think what we could see is this horrendous, prolonged process, which could go on for well over a decade, which could ultimately end up in some form of backtracking, could end up with them staying in the single market, possibly. But I think that there's a real chance that at the end of March 2018, that there won't be any deal. And we will be talking about the UK potentially going out to going into the WTO system. If they don't somehow get their act together. And at the moment, there is no sign of that happening. There is no unity in the cabinet. There is a high risk of an election again. And if there is an election, that could lead to a change, obviously, at the top. And it could lead to Jeremy Corbyn becoming Prime Minister.
We've got to leave it there. We're out of time. Thank you all very much indeed for coming in today. Hope that you can join me again on RT1 television at 10:35 on Monday night. Have a great weekend.
Saturday with Claire Byrne was produced by Anne Farrell. The broadcast coordinator was Lisa McGeough. Research was by Killian Murray, and Noel Roberts was on sound.